Fan Junkies Radio is brought to you by FanJunkies.net, where sports meet social networking. All right, well, now it seems we're on the air, Mike.
All righty.
At least I hope so.
Let's
if we're not in the air, I hope somebody emails us or calls us and says, hey, listen, it's a bunch of dead air.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Man, I tell you, man, it's been nothing but horrible times today. It's been an awful Friday, Mike.
Is it the 13th today?
Huh? I don't think so.
No, it's the 19th, I think,
it's
right?
It's the 19th, man. It's awful.
Ah!
Well, anyway, we should be on the air. I'm actually going to go sign in right now just to make sure we are on here. Mike, listen, it's Friday, why not?
Yeah, really.
Although, you know what, I'm not loading up here, so I hope we don't lose another internet connection. It's going to be terrible if we do. You there, Mike?
I'm here.
Listen, you know what, it can't go any worse today, so let's just talk and let's just start it out here. It's Friday. It's been a terrible Friday here at Fan Junkies Radio. Nothing but technical difficulties. You know what? But it's going to be a good show as long as we can stay on air, Mike.
Yeah, I hear you.
joining us today is Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame President Ken Avalon. We're going to speak about, why he created the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame, what the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame is all about,
right.
And, of course, the 2012 the class of 2012 inductees that consist of so many great Philadelphia names like Doug Collins, Eric Lindros, Mike Piazza, Joe Klecko, Eddie Plank, Tommy Thompson, Wally Jones, and so many others, Mike.
Right, absolutely.
It'd be good. I'm looking forward to it.
So am I.
But let's start off with baseball, Mike.
Yeah.
And last night it happened. The inevitable happened. The New York Yankees were swept 4-0 by the monster Detroit Tigers, Mike.
Yeah.
It's something we spoke about over the last couple of shows, and it actually happened. Mike, what do you see the problems here with the Yankees? Andy Pettitte says, last night, and I quote, obviously we're getting older, but that didn't happen in the 162-game season because they led the league in wins.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to hear that kind of nonsense. To me, that's a cop-out.
Big time.
Excuse me, we're getting older. That's nonsense. You weren't getting older during a 162-game regular season.
Yeah.
I talked about it a little bit last night on 5 Minutes at the Frat House. This team, you could almost see it happening almost from, the beginning of August, that they were just beginning to unravel.
Yes.
And it all culminated in the ALCS, which is the worst possible time for it to happen.
Yes.
We saw the multiple benchings of multiple stars on that team repeatedly, including A-Rod. This team, as I pointed out to Sidekick on the show last night, I said, this team looked to me like the Boston Red Sox from last year. And you cannot tell me that this team is not going to be under a microscope. I can tell you right now, if I were the ownership, it would be under a microscope in the offseason for me.
Yeah.
That's for darn sure.
Yeah.
There's no reason why listen. To lose, that would be one thing. They got swept. The Yankees got swept. And don't get me wrong, I am not a Yankees fan by any stretch of the imagination. I'm thrilled to see that they're out of there.
Yes.
But this is not the type of team that you expect to see getting swept 4-0 to the Detroit Tigers of all teams.
Well, I mean, you know what? You can't discount the fact that the Tigers played a damn good series.
I'm not. But that was not a team that I think anybody really had on their radar for a good portion of the season.
Yes.
I mean, coming out of that particular division, I would have thought for the longest time it was going to be the White Sox.
Yeah.
So, talk about a team. Listen, I give hats off to the Detroit Tigers. I really do. I give them a lot of credit. They came on at the right time. It's another typical situation of a team getting hot at the right time.
Yeah.
But my goodness, the Yankees swept by in four. You know, now of course the whole you know, all the storylines are around A-Rod.
Yeah.
You know, they were apparently shopping them. You know, even before the playoffs were over, the stories were coming out that the Yankees were shopping them.
Yes.
He says this morning, listen, I got a no trade clause, and there is no way I'm waiving it. I plan on being right back here next year as a Yankee. I got something to prove. I know I didn't do my job this year.
Yeah, Yankee fans don't want him.
Listen, the Yankees don't want him. You know, the reports I've heard is that they're willing to pick up as much as 80% of his salary.
Hey, why not?
I mean, you know, what team wouldn't take that? I tell you right now, the Philadelphia Phillies can need a third baseman.
Oh, trust me, dude. You don't want A-Rod on your team.
Listen, at an 80% discount,
you have enough headaches at first base, man.
Well, I hear you. Well, I hear you, but, you know, at an 80% discount, why not?
Well, yeah, if you're that cheap, why not? But then again, like we said during the pre-show, and as you said, he's nothing but the MLB's equivalent of Kobe Bryant, but I had to say it, without the talent.
Well, you know, you were talking about that a little bit, right, at pre-show. We were talking about the egotism he's got. I mean, it's just outrageous.
Yeah, it's disgusting what he.
And so I recognize that any team he goes to, you better have a solid foundation of players going in there to be able to put up with that egomaniac individual.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like I said, at an 80% discount, and if you listen, for 2 years, 3 years, if the guy can hit me 25 home runs out of the third base position. I don't know. I might give it some thought.
He's getting old, Mike.
You know, he's what, 37?
You know what? That pink lip gloss and the steroids, they're not working on one. But then again, listen. All right, the Tigers won. The great thing I thought about it was, you know what? Yankees fans, they wanted Curtis Granderson so bad. Oh, yeah, you know what? The Yankees, they ripped off the Tigers. Well, you know what? It didn't look like that last night. Austin Jackson, Phil Koch.
Yeah.
I mean, Phil Koch dominated the Yankees out of the bullpen this series.
Yes, he certainly did.
Austin Jackson, batting .353, mm-hmm. You know, had two hits last night, another RBI. I mean, it doesn't look like that no more now, does it?
No. No.
Amazing stuff, I tell you.
You know, and that's what I'm saying. I think, you know, this team, probably more than any other, is going to get really, really magnified in the offseason.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, man. You know, some people are going and some people are staying. And
It wouldn't surprise me in the least if we saw a spring training with a completely different crew.
You know what? Let's see if the son Steinbrenner or anything like their father, you know.
Well, yeah.
And so off season, you're going to hear it, you know, especially like, you know, today, you know, guy made a good point. Ronald Blum over at Yahoo Sports said if this was still George Steinbrenner's Yankees, George Steinbrenner would have issued a public apology to the fans.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from some New York fans at some point during the show, particularly Yankee fans. I don't know how the New York media is reporting it up there. I mean, is Girardi taking any heat?
Oh, Girardi's been taking heat for a while now.
I mean, is there any possibility that, you know, we're going to lay this at the feet of the manager?
Yeah, I would think there would be a possibility that Joe Girardi wouldn't come back as manager. I mean, you know what? The fans don't like him. You know, they don't like any, you know, the managerial decisions that he makes on the field, and especially with his bullpen.
The fans up there don't like any match.
Why not, you know?
Because I like Girardi.
Yes.
And I think he's done a fine job.
Yeah.
And as an alumnus of the team, you know, I think he's done well. You know, you tell me the Yankee fans don't like him, I say, well, you know, tell me somebody the Yankee fans do like.
Yeah.
You know. But I would like to hear from some up there because, you know, I'd like to know how the media is reporting it at this particular time. Are they putting the blame at the feet of somebody like A-Rod? Are they putting it at Girardi? Are they putting it at the feet of the entire team? You know, how's the media up there reporting this absolute – I mean, really, it's a disaster.
No, yeah, it really is. And you know what? We would love to take some calls from some Yankees fans if anybody's listening out there in Yankee land or if you're still standing on the side of the bridge. We'll be taking the calls after we speak to our guest, Ken Avalon, from the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame. The number is 347-237-5373. once we wrap up with Ken, we'll be taking some calls from, everybody, but hopefully we hear from some Yankee fans.
Yep, absolutely.
So, listen, Mike, the Tigers are going to the World Series.
Yep.
Tonight, Cardinals and Giants.
Yep.
We have Zito going up against Lynn. I just don't see how Barry Zito is going to limit the St. Louis Cardinals' bats. To me, it looks like it's going to be Tigers-Cardinals World Series. That's going to be a very exciting World Series.
I would agree. And frankly, you know, again, we were talking about this last night on 5 Minutes at the Frat House, and of course, Sidekick is a big St. Louis fan, as I've pointed out numerous times. You know, he's being cautiously optimistic. You know, he thinks it's going to go to a 7 games. I said outright on the show, I see this being wrapped up in Game 5. Is Game 5 today, by the way?
Yeah, it's Game 5.
That's what I thought.
Let me see. Yep, Game 5 of 7.
And what time is that game today, dude?
That's at 8 o'clock tonight.
Okay.
Barry Zito going up against Lance Lynn.
Right. I had a feeling that today was going to be Game 5. And I think I think that's going to get wrapped up. And I think you're going to be looking at Detroit and the Cardinals. And frankly, I'd have to give the edge to the Cardinals in the series.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Mike. Well, I believe we have our guest on the line right now. Joining us right now is Ken Avalon, the president of the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame. Ken, how you doing?
Good. How's it going, guys?
Ken, how are you?
Going really good.
Doing great. How are you?
Good. Ken, we appreciate having you on. This is terrific. We know you've got a busy, busy schedule because you got an induction coming up shortly. One of the things that I had been bringing up to Jonathan was the fact that you know, Philadelphia, we've got so much culture. We got so much history. We got so many landmarks. You know, we got the Betsy Ross House, and we got Independence Hall, and we got all kinds of wonderful history. We got some great museums. A lot of people are not aware of the fact that we do have our own Sports Hall of Fame, which you started. And I love the story. I think the story of how the whole thing started is a terrific one. And I wanted to give you a couple of minutes to tell us and tell our listeners exactly how that whole thing came about, because it's a really neat story, in my opinion.
Yeah, sure thing. Back in May of 2002, I was reading Frank Fitzpatrick. He used to write Insights. He used to write on, Friday mornings for the Inquirer. And one of the questions he posed, he goes, wouldn't it be great if there was a Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame? I read it. I said, "Well, there's got to be somewhere." So I did some research. Got to spend a couple of weeks doing some research, and couldn't find one. I mean, there were some, you know, kind of niche halls of fame. There was the Philadelphia Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, Big Five Hall of Fame, Philadelphia A's Society. They have their own
right.
group where they honor individuals, but nothing for the entire city. You know, all sports.
Yeah.
So there were some friends. Some family members, and we said, what do you guys think? Want to kind of give it a shot? And we did. We spent about a year doing research. We contacted a number of regional halls of fame, Syracuse Sports Hall of Fame, Texas Sports Hall of Fame, Virginia, Tennessee, places like that. Basically, think out, what worked well for them, what were some of the pitfalls that we could avoid. And I said, after about a year, we wrote our charter, constitution, bylaws, kind of how the whole process will run. And then in June of 2003, we kind of went public with it. Sent out a press release. Patrick picked it up, and we were on page one of the sports page in June of 2003.
Wow,
it's a really, really cool story because and I've read reports on how it all started. I mean, literally, it started like from your kitchen table. I mean, and that's what's really cool to me about it is that it's a very homespun creation.
Exactly right. We took turns here at my house, some of the other people's houses. Literally, it would be after work or on weekend mornings. We're all real jobs, kids, playing sports and whatnot. So in our spare time, late at night, early in the morning is kind of when we met. And you're right, homespun from a bunch of Philly sports fans.
And now here you are. We're inducting now our 9th class on November 8th. 9 classes of Philadelphia athletes. And these are guys, the other thing I love about it is that, all of us, you would expect, the big teams. You'd expect, the Eagles and the Phils and the Flyers and whatnot. But you guys cover everything. I mean, you cover college sports. You cover some of the most, you know, Olympians. I mean, tell us some about some of the classes that have gone in.
Sure. Well, when we started, we again, this was kind of some of the insight we got from some of the various halls of fame we dealt with, was the fact that the most success they had was doing all sports at all levels. It would have been easy to stick with the Big Four teams and induct a couple of guys a year and kind of get some press out of that. But from our perspective, we wanted to make sure we really did, you know, kind of delve in the depth and breadth of Philly sports. So you're right. We actually do the Big Four sports, but we also go into, you know, we'll go into boxing, go into, you know, women's basketball, lacrosse, tennis, rowing, golf, Olympians are in there, diving, that type of thing. And it's some of the, and what's neat about it is you're able to kind of, I don't want to use the term resurrect, but, you know, kind of do some research on some people that, you know, some sports figures that people never may not have heard of or haven't heard of for 50, 60, 70 years.
Yeah.
Just this year, as a matter of fact, we have Johnny McDermott going in. He's the first American to win the U.S. Open. He actually won two U.S. Opens. I mean, imagine a guy like that these days, he'd be all over the place. Cover Sports Illustrated, tons of sponsorships and whatnot, but he's almost a forgotten man.
Yes. That's a great example. That was one I was actually going to bring up to you. McDermott, who played on the PGA Tour from, what, 1910 to 1914, I believe. That was a name, you know, when I was doing research, that was a name that I did not know. And so in many respects, by virtue of what you're doing, you're actually bringing public awareness, not just to the fact that there's a Hall of Fame, but to some of these otherwise not known athletes.
Exactly. There's kind of, I don't want to use the term niche sports, but they're not in the Big Four. Take a guy like a Joe Brewer. He was a swimmer, went to North Catholic, went to LaSalle College, and he was a world record holder. I think it's something like 15 to 20 world records, he said, in the breaststroke. It would have been in 1944 Olympics, but the 44 Olympics didn't happen because of the war. So he was in the 48 Olympics, and he won two golds there. What's interesting is he had his two gold medals, and he was scheduled to swim in another relay race, and he gave up his spot for somebody else on the team who didn't have a medal. So his other fella got the gold medal.
The criteria, and it looks like to me, if I'm not mistaken, what we're inducting 16. Is that correct? There are 16 inductees. Okay.
Yep.
What is the criteria? Because obviously some of these, it's not that you have to be a Philadelphia native, right?
No, we have the basic two criteria. You either need to be, we'll use the term local. You know, either born here or maybe somebody like a Joe Frazier who, you know, kind of came here early and came to Philadelphia. Or your career was here. Mike Schmidt, you know, Bernie Perron, Steve Carlton. So it's either, you know, from the area or you know, the bulk of your career was here in the area.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, even looking at some of the names, Tommy Thompson is definitely one of those as an example, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Tommy Thompson, he quarterbacked the Eagles back in the late 40s to three straight championship games, and he won the final two in 48 and 49. But again, he's a guy, you know, went to, you know, University of Tulsa, but he played here for the Eagles, and, you know, from our perspective, that qualifies him, you know, especially with that, you know, that kind of run of success that he had.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So, Ken, you know what, let me ask you this. it's going to be held at the Sheridan Society Hill, November 8th, the inductees. Now, you know what, I'm sure you're just, you know, a monstrous sports fan. You know, do you get excited at some of these names that, you know what, your Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame is inducting, you know, more from a fan perspective than being the president of the Hall of Fame?
For me, I tell you what's kind of what I find rewarding is the fact that we are able to recognize, you know, some of these more, you know, less well-known names.
Yes.
Like this year, as a matter of fact, everybody knows Eric Lindros and you know, Wally Jones. A lot of people know Wally Jones, Mike Piazza, names like that. But, you know, Doug Collins, obviously. But when you get into, say, maybe a Debbie Black, I mean, she's well-known in women's basketball circles. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, probably not very well-known. Dan Baker, everybody knows Dan Baker. But, you know, take Horace Ashenfelter. You know, he won a gold medal in the 1952 Olympics. You know, it's nice to be able to recognize folks like that. And what I find interesting is that folks, you know, kind of in that category tend to appreciate it more, whether they're still around or whether their family's still around. And they really seem to appreciate the recognition and the honor.
Mm-hmm. How many, Ken, are total now in the hall? Now, you know, with the eight previous classes, and if we combine it with the 16 that are going in now, how many will that bring you to?
I'd have to check my math, but I believe we're at in the 120s, 120s in that area.
Okay.
Wow.
And one of the things that's been addressed a lot is the fact that, you know, yeah, there's a Hall of Fame, and when you hear about Hall of Fames, you know, you think about Cooperstown, or you think about the NFL Hall of Fame, or, it, you know, it's some place that you can go. But we don't have a place that we can go here in Philadelphia, do we? There's no real
don't.
Museum.
That's correct. And in a way, I guess we're somewhat victims of our own success. When we you know, kind of got together and planned out we spent that year planning out that, you know, plotting out the future of the Hall of Fame and the processes and whatnot. And our focus was really on the annual recognition of the athletes and coaches and participants, really the annual induction. And so in that sense, we had such great success with every one of our inductions has just been terrific. Folks figure, okay, well, the Hall of Fame, they think museum. And the truth is, I mean, we have a long range vision to be in a museum, but the truth is it's a tough business, especially these days in this economy. You look at a number of the museums in the area, and they're just, it's tough. It's a tough business model. We've met with a number of different folks over the years, you know, with some possibilities. But the truth is, we haven't really been able to come up with a real solid business plan with the renewable revenue in order to have a publicly accessible museum space.
The concern, I guess, is more viability. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's exactly right. I mean, you know, we'll have a meeting. And everybody loves the idea, loves the concept. I mean, you look at what we have. We're dealing with over 120-something years of sports history. People see these names. It brings back memories.
Yeah.
What we'll do, at some of the meetings, we'll bring, we have a terrific collection of sports memorabilia, you know, things that have been donated, those types of things. And people love the idea. And, oh, yeah, man, you know, count me in, you know. And then, okay, we put the numbers together, put the plan together, and the truth is you're not going to sustain a museum on attendance, on people walking through the door. You know,
right.
You're going to need an endowment there for ongoing business expenses. And, you know, when somebody's donating a large chunk of money to a museum, you know, pick your number, 10,000, 100,000, a million. The number almost doesn't matter.
Yeah.
They want to see their name attached to a given museum or exhibit or a wing.
Mm-hmm.
What they don't want to do is see, you know, half of that money or 75% of that money go to a ledger account as an endowment.
Right,
so
right.
That's the struggle. That's the real struggle. It's funding, like pretty much any other business.
Right. I mean, because I, for one, to me, it would be a thrill to walk through a museum of these folks. And as you point out, you know, just be able to walk around and see the memorabilia, you know, that whole concept of walking down memory lane. You know, I'm such a geek for that sort of thing. It would be terrific, but I understand the problems that exist today economically with trying to sustain this. Now, you did have a small, I guess, kind of office space and staging area, I believe. Where was that, Ken? Was it the Port Richmond section?
It's in Northern Liberties.
Northern
and,
Liberties, that's where it was.
Yeah, Northern Liberties. And you're right, we're actually in the final stages of closing that operation down. And essentially what we were able to do there was set up, you know, scaled down versions of what maybe a large scale museum exhibit would look like. You know, maybe the Palestra, we have a number of items from the Palestra. So we'll catalog it, digitally capture everything, digitally curate everything. So we're able to create kind of almost a virtual inventory of exhibits.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked really well. We're able to do that. As I said, we're closing things down. We're in the process of moving to a new location. We're not at liberty to announce that location just yet. We're working out the final details.
Okay.
But by the induction, by November 8th, we'll definitely be able to have that announcement.
But you do have a place. You're able to secure a place.
We're able to secure a place, and the good news is that it will be more publicly accessible than where we were down in Northern Liberties. So it's definitely a step up for us.
That's fantastic. That's terrific. Great news. I'm thrilled to hear it. Would it be the type of thing that visitors could come in and see perhaps a rotating or changing type of display of things?
Exactly. What we'll do, we have some items that we're going to call base items. They're real neat architectural items from some of the various venues. You know, we have items from the Vet, from the Palestra, from the Spectrum, from St. Joe's Fieldhouse. And they'll kind of form the backdrop of the exhibit area, of the kind of the gallery area. And then what we'll do, we'll, in addition to the Hall of Fame, but we'll have obviously a tribute to each of the inductee classes. But in addition to that, we will have rotating exhibits, as I said, from our collection. We have a number of folks who've, kind of pledged their support, pledged parts of their collections once we have an ability to display that. So it really does open up a lot of possibilities for us.
That's terrific. That's terrific. I'm thrilled to hear it. The induction coming up, as we pointed out, on November 8th, and as Jonathan pointed out, is down at the Society Hill Sheraton. People can still get into that. Is that right, Ken?
Yeah, that's correct. We, again, sales have been brisk. We're actually ahead of last year, and last year was a sellout. But as of this point, there are still tickets available, both VIP admission and general admission. Yep.
And how can people get a hold of this?
Easiest way is to go online. It's phillyhall.org/class9. You go out there, you'll see all the information about the class, all the inductees. On the right-hand side, you'll see information, registration, special guests who are coming, event sponsors, all that. And you can literally sign up right online.
And if somebody new were to come to that, what could they expect for that evening?
Well, what we've got, a couple of years ago, we took a little bit of a different approach. Five or six years, we had your classic banquet, an hour open bar, and then you go in, you sit down to an hour and a half dinner, and then we go into the induction. But I guess it was 3 years ago, we said, Pat Williams pulled me aside during the reception. He says, Ken, you know what? People love this, socializing. So what we do is we actually change it into more of a reception. It's about a 2.5-hour reception with entree stations, open bar, and then we go into the program, which is now only about an hour and a half. So we're able to shrink down the length of the program. So what you'll have during the reception, we've got a full entree station, open bar, the whole bit. We've got a museum exhibit set up towards dedicated to this class. We have a couple different videos going on, and then we always have a couple different special ops. We might have a couple of sports writers, signing books. A lot of times we have some special guests, Phillies ball girls, Eagles cheerleaders, those types of things. So it's really a very, very festive kind of event. And then we go right in. Pat Williams, he's back again as our MC. And then we go into the induction where we go through each of the individuals. And it generally lasts, it's probably about 9:30 we wrap up. So we had been wrapping up, 10:30, 11 o'clock. So ends up, we kind of get people out the door pretty early.
And this gives people an opportunity people do get an opportunity to get up close kind of with some of these folks. Like, for instance, Doug Collins being there or Mike Piazza, if he's in attendance, hopefully, people would be able to actually get up and speak with him. Is that correct? In this type
That's
of
right.
event?
It will be during the reception time. Yeah, as I said, yep. it's an open reception. Literally, it's all the inductees are there. We're fortunate enough to have a lot of the past inductees come back every year, and most of them are very accessible. They really are. Once the program starts, people are sitting at the table. Much less so. They don't like people being bothered at the table. But absolutely,
right.
during the reception area, most of the folks are very accessible.
Well, I think. I think it's a tremendous story.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I'll tell you, Ken, it's one that I support. I wish everything the best for it. I'd love to see you get a full scale museum. I understand the dilemmas with putting that together. For folks that are out there again who are interested in this, Philadelphia is just rich with all kinds of sports history. Phillyhall.org is where you want to go to check out all of those things that are related to Philadelphia sports and the Hall of Fame inductees and what have you, all nine classes. Ken, terrific. I appreciate you being on with us. And we wish you the very, very best with all of this, you know, this year and as you continue forward.
My pleasure, guys. I love it. Hopefully I'll see you guys November 8th.
You got it.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Ken.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Bye now. Yep.
Great stuff.
Yeah, it is. I'm curious, you know, of course, listen, I'm a bit biased. I'm a Philadelphia native. You know, and when I heard about this sort of thing, I think it's, you know, and being the type of person I am and, you know, I guess my age and what have you, and I go back a bit with some of these guys, I thought it was terrific. I'm often been curious to know how many cities have this sort of thing. But I think the thing that really struck me, I guess, most about it was its genesis.
Yeah.
And how Ken just kind of, you know, he read something and he came up with this idea. And from that, it just spurred him to go forward and create this thing.
And you know what? Unfortunately, it took somebody that long to get it because, like you said, and, you know, me being a New Yorker, you know, I know of Philadelphia, you know, sports firsthand. It's such a rich city full of some really good sports stuff, you know.
Sure.
And to me, every city in America that is a rich sports city deserves to have a sports Hall of Fame.
There's no doubt about it.
And you know what? Just for Ken to come up with it and actually have that drive him to do it, you know, I commend him. You know, so many kudos go to him for doing it.
Absolutely.
And you know what? And the great thing is about it is that, you know, Philadelphia sports fans who are interested in the Sports Hall of Fame, they can donate money to them. And, you know, we actually ask you to do it because it's such a great thing and it's such a great event. If you go to phillyhall.org and click on membership, you know, you can donate money and, you know, and be a part of the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame firsthand.
Well, and you hear, you know, the dilemma that you know, Ken expresses. You hear the dilemma, and I'm sure it's a dilemma in other cities, where perhaps maybe they have something similar or they're considering starting something similar. And Ken is so right, because I used to work in the nonprofit sector, and I know the struggles that museums have.
Yeah.
Membership, admission, all of that, and a lot of times you go to these places, and you're paying $20 a person or something to just walk through, and you go, wow, that's really expensive. You know something, folks? It doesn't cover the cost of running something like that.
Yeah.
Of changing displays, of just keeping everything going. So I fully understand exactly what Ken's saying. I would love to see the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame have a museum that I could take my kids to, that, you know, I could take my nieces or my cousins or whomever.
Oh, absolutely. And not even that. You know what? Visiting fans of other sports teams, you know, if you're a real fan of sports, it's just a great thing to see, you know?
Sure. And how many times, Jonathan, I know you can probably speak to it yourself. You go to an out-of-town. I know for myself. I've gone down to Baltimore many times.
Yes.
I love the Baltimore area. I love the city of Baltimore.
Yes.
I have gone through their museums, their sports museums, repeatedly. And yet I'm a Philadelphia fan. And I get as much out of some of those museums down in Baltimore and other cities as I would. Listen, I'd have the same feeling if I went to one in New York.
Yeah, listen, that's the definition of a true sports fan. It's
exactly
loving the sport, and it's learning about the sport.
Exactly.
You don't just have to be all about your team. You can be about the sport. Nobody's going to kill you, you know?
You got it.
But what's great, too, is with this whole induction class, and, I wanted to say it, but I was so intrigued with Ken's story, is that, you know, you do have the names people know. Mike Piazza, Eric Lindros, Joe Klecko, Doug Collins, Wally Jones. But then there's names that not many people know, especially Philadelphia fans.
Right.
And, you know, Debbie Black, Johnny McDermott, Horace Ashenfelter. I mean, you know, even for me, Debbie Black, it brings me back to when the WNBA was first coming around.
Yes.
And when she was playing with the Stars, and then she played with the very short-lived Miami Soul, you know, so I haven't heard of Debbie Black in years.
Yeah, and that was part of what I was bringing up early on, is I love the mission.
Exactly.
Because it would be so easy to just concentrate on the Big Four.
Yes.
But no, that's not what this particular organization does. they have stretched it down the line to make sure that, you know, a lot of the folks that perhaps have gone from our memory are still remembered.
Yes.
And I think that that's a terrific.
You know, and it would be great, man. I would so love to be a part of a committee for some city's Hall of Fame that can look at these names every year and be one of the people that chose who to get to. You know, just looking at Horace Ashenfelter, who was an American athlete, won a gold medal in 1952 in Helsinki, a silver in 1955. You know, to look at all these names and say, well, you know what, I've never heard of Horace Ashenfelter before, and I'm sure a lot of people haven't, even on the Hall of Fame committee, and say, well, let's learn what he's about and see how much he's done for sports.
Yes.
And, you know, born in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, it must be really neat to be a part of that and to be able to put these people into it and honor them.
Yeah, I mean, it concerned me a little bit when I first looked at the induction list way back, I guess, in July when I went down to their press conference. It concerned me a little bit that I did know the name Eddie Plank for the Philadelphia Athletics, who played in 1901. That did concern me a little bit.
What are you trying to say, Mike? Were you around in 1901 watching Philadelphia baseball?
No, it just goes to show you how big of a baseball fan I am. But, no, I mean, you know, not that I was around in 1901, folks. I don't want you to think that. But, no, you're absolutely right.
Listen, you know what would be great? If we can get a Mike Piazza or a Joe Klecko on or a Doug Collins or whatever after the induction to really ask them about this Sports Hall of Fame and what it means to them.
Yeah, that actually would be kind of cool.
You know, maybe we you know, can have Ken on for the same show again too with that person. You know, maybe we can talk to Ken about that. It'd be great. You know, and I'm sure the listeners would love it.
Yep. Yep.
All right. Well, you know what? We have just a little over 20 minutes left, Mike.
Well, you know what I would say to tie in with it, if there's anybody out there who's in another city, if you've got a Sports Hall of Fame that's just for your city, call us in and let us know what yours is like. I'd like to hear.
Definitely. The number is 347-237-5373. Call in. Let us know about your city's Hall of Fame and if every other city should have one. All right, Mike, let's talk a little football now.
Yeah.
We had a little bit of a crazy night last night between the 49ers and the Seattle Seahawks. The 49ers defeated the Seahawks 13-6.
Uh-huh.
But it's the aftermath of the game that is having so many people talking. I guess with, 43 seconds to go, I guess there was a chop block in the end zone, flag in the end zone. It was a safety. 49ers head coach Jim Harbaugh elected to decline the safety so he can keep the ball there and not give the Seahawks a chance to get the ball back.
Yeah.
But what are we hearing now is, he took points off the board, and they didn't cover the 7.5-point spread. Gamblers are going bananas today, Mike.
Yeah, well, yeah. All right, gamblers are going crazy, yeah, because, of course, apparently San Francisco – or San Fran was favored by 7.5.
Yep.
And so, therefore, with it being a 13-6 margin, they didn't cover the spread. Now, be that as it may – let's just take a look for a moment at the play, and let's look at it from the standpoint of football, all right? First of all, the first rule of thumb is, I thought, anyhow, you don't ever take points off the board. Wouldn't that be correct, Jonathan?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. Set it up. It was 4th and 17. 4th and 17 for the Seahawks, all right? And I forget exactly what yard line they're on, but they're deep, deep, deep into their zone.
Yes.
And Wilson drops back for a pass. He is in his end zone, all right? He did not get sacked. He fired the ball, and damn near didn't the receiver almost get the first down. Came up inches short of the first down.
Yes.
So he almost had the 4th and 17 covered. However, a flag is thrown into the end zone. You know, a lot of the viewers, we didn't see it because it was thrown off to the side. There was a chop block. Two men blocking a defenseman coming into the zone, going to attack Wilson. Apparently, and I've not seen this very often, where a penalty results in a safety. Tell me the last time you saw that.
I haven't seen it, but it is in the rule book. So,
okay.
You know.
So, there, right there, that's an anomaly.
Yes.
Right there was the fact that, oh, my goodness, you know, listen, this wasn't a situation where Wilson was sacked. That's a clear safety. All right, now, let's keep going forward. All right.
And by the way, they were on the Seattle 4.
Okay, there you go. All right, now, let's keep taking it forward. It's ruled a safety. That's now 2 points in favor of the 49ers. That would have put the score at 15-6.
Yes.
Harbaugh decides to decline the penalty, which then takes the safety off the board so that the 49ers can take over on downs.
Mm-hmm.
All right, wait a minute. Is that a smart move? Football-wise, really?
Let me ask you this. Even if they got the safety and somehow, some way, Seattle got the ball back, ran it back in for a touchdown, got the two-point conversion, they still would have been down by one. Correct?
All right, well, wait a minute. Hold on. Wait a minute. Let's remember, after a safety, not only do you get the 2 points, you get the ball back.
Yeah. But like I said, even if Alex Smith took an interception, whatever, you can still kneel it down.
Okay, but wait a minute. Now it's a two-possession situation.
Exactly.
Now you're ahead by nine.
It's pulled after they got the ball. So what was the sense of Harbaugh declining the safety?
And there's my point. All right, so we're in agreement.
Yeah. But let me ask you this, though. How bad do you think Paul McQuiston feels today?
I beg your pardon? I'm sorry.
I said, how bad do you think Paul McQuiston feels today, the offensive lineman from the Seahawks that actually got the chop block?
Well, for sure, because can I tell you right now, it was damn close. It was damn close to being a first down.
Yes.
Now, more than likely, I mean, had it gone exactly
it was a first down, wasn't it? It was a 16-yard pass.
No, it was short. It was just short.
Really? It was 4th and 17. I'm seeing. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. It was just short of a first down.
Turned it over on downs. So.
But you know, so many different things could have come into play. Remember, that was a chop block.
Yes.
Okay. So that meant there were two defenders in the end zone. Well, all right. If one of those defenders isn't there, maybe one of those offensive defenders rather, maybe one of them are up the way. And are creating a block so that he does get the first down. You understand what I'm saying? There's a lot of ifs, I understand.
Absolutely.
But it was so close to being a first down that, you know, listen, it's very – you know, Monday Night Football. Listen, it's Seattle. You know, what can I tell you? Why shouldn't the game end this way? It's Seattle.
It's nuts. It is nuts, I tell you. It really is nuts. You know, what else can you say about it?
Jonathan, I sat here watching it live, and I am standing up, and I'm looking at watching this play out in front of me, and I don't know, it's like 3 after 11.
What the hell is going on?
Exactly. It's 20 after 11, something like that. I'm going, what in the world are you doing? You're going to take points off the ball. At least you gave you 2 points plus the ball.
Yeah.
And you're declining? I fully understand if people are calling into question Harbaugh. I fully understand it. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to indicate that, you know, perhaps there was some sort of, you know, financial collusion involved in this. I think that's taking it a little bit over the line.
Yeah.
Which is what I have read on some websites. You know, there is some speculation out there that, in fact, the 49ers and Harbaugh were, you know, that this was a conceived situation, that this situation occurred, and so therefore they took the points off the board because they recognized that, you know, it was going to affect betting lines in some way or another.
Yeah.
I think that's overstepping it. I think that's a little overblown.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think nonetheless, Harbaugh needs to be questioned on
why
that type of management.
Yeah, why?
Why would you do that? I'd love to hear from callers. You know, is that the right call? Have you ever seen a call or heard of a call like that? And do you think that's a good thing? Really?
I don't know. It was ridiculous in a way, but you know what? Until we hear Harbaugh's side of things and why he did it, I'm going to reserve judgment on that. So,
I mean, even the announcers were questioning it. And I forget who the announcers were. Well, of course, it was Thursday Night Football. But they were even questioning it at the very moment. But then one of them comes back afterwards and says, well, you know, I kind of understand. Well, you know, that was a little bit of backpedaling.
Yeah.
Because, you know, to me, it's a win-win. You're getting a safety. You're getting 2 points. Plus, you're getting the ball with how many seconds? 43 seconds left?
43 seconds left. Correct.
You're getting the ball. Now it's a two-possession situation. So even if you screw up, even if you fumble the ball, on a kneel down or something to that effect, it's still a two-possession situation.
Yeah. I don't know, Mike. It was definitely crazy. It was definitely something that I could not wrap my head around. And like I said, until Harbaugh actually says something about it, we're not going to know anything about it.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, as I watched it, it was one of the most bizarre plays I'd ever seen.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's stick with football because something just came out here, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Former Minnesota Vikings defensive lineman Jimmy Kennedy, who was identified as the whistleblower in the New Orleans Saints bounty scandal,
yep,
has released a real lengthy statement today blasting NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, calling him a liar in his regard to his role in the league's investigation. Kennedy states in the letter that, you know, that Roger Goodell also states that I was interviewed by the NFL about the alleged bounty. That is another lie. I had no knowledge about any alleged bounty to reveal it to anyone. I was never interviewed by the NFL unless the NFL considers two 30-second conversations when I told NFL security that I had no knowledge of any such allegations interviews. I certainly do not. Now, Mike, this has been a mess since day one, this whole bounty gate thing.
Yeah.
You know, now Jimmy Kennedy is coming out and saying, listen, I have no idea why these players are suspended. I have no idea how this came to light. I have no idea why I was labeled as the whistleblower. Is this going to give those NFL players even more leverage in a lawsuit against Roger Goodell and the NFL now?
All right. Well, you know, the whole thing's starting to get really, really muddied, isn't it?
Big time.
And
it's painting Goodell and the NFL in a very, very, very poor color.
Well, yeah, particularly in light of the fact that there was a report yesterday that apparently the NFL, in fact, endorsed this type of activity going back to 1996. I mean...
Listen, you know what? I'm sure this has happened even before that. You know, I don't necessarily think that they were looking to hurt players. I think it was more of an edge to get them to play harder. But then again, I mean, what the hell, you know?
Well, you know, it's starting to get very, very, let's put it this way. I, for one, had no reason to doubt that, you know, what was going on was going on. I had no reason to doubt it.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought that, in fact, in other words, it didn't surprise me. Let's put it that way. But now, when you're starting to hear how the NFL management has conducted themselves throughout the entire series of things.
Yeah.
How Goodell has been less than forthcoming about information that he's had. He's been less than forthcoming with players that have been involved in the situation. You know, it's starting to leave nagging doubts.
Yes.
In your head.
Yeah.
NFLPA cites 1996 bounty program allowed by NFL.
Yeah.
That was the article that I was looking at this morning on USA Today. You know, isn't this a contradiction?
It's just, like you said, it's really muddy right now. It's probably going to get even muddier. You know, now all of a sudden, the guy who was supposedly this big whistleblower on this whole thing, he's coming out saying, listen, I never said anything, so where the hell are you getting this information from?
We'll have to wait and see how
he even said that, you know, after the second phone call, which was like a 30-second conversation with the NFL, he told his agent, who then retained an attorney for him, when they informed the NFL security that any other contact with Jimmy Kennedy would have to go through the lawyer, they never called the lawyer. They never spoke to Jimmy Kennedy again.
Well, is that what he's claiming, that it was a total of how long they interviewed him?
Yeah, 30 seconds each, two phone calls.
Wow.
You know, and then one of the other guys says, I am not one of the players who have been officially disciplined by the NFL as part of this sham, but I now know that I have too been damaged by the NFL's complete disregard for truth and integrity.
All right, well, Jonathan, let me ask you a question, though.
Shoot.
Doesn't it seem a little odd to you that this guy would wait this long to come out? Why wouldn't you make this statement before?
I wonder, you know.
Why wouldn't you come out? I mean, all this nonsense has been going on since what? Since right after the Super Bowl, since March. Why wouldn't you make a statement?
Well, because he issued the statement in response to a recent memo the NFL gave to all teams that listed him specifically as the person who originally told former Vikings head coach Brad Childress in early 2010
right.
that the Saints had a bounty on Brett Favre in the 2010 NFC title game.
Right.
So maybe he didn't even know he was the whistleblower. All
yeah.
of a sudden now this memo comes out with his name on it. You know, it's ridiculous. What the hell is going on here? I mean, who's right? Who's wrong? Who's lying? Who's not? It's going to take a while for everybody to figure that out, I think, Mike.
To be perfectly honest, I, for one, would just like to see the whole thing go away.
It would be nice.
I think it's a distraction.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it's a lot of who shot John.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of finger-pointing going on. Look, suck it up. Let's get it done with. This kind of thing, in my opinion, should not be going on. I think it's a disgrace. If it went on in the past... It went on in the past, but from this point forward, let's just say that it's over with, and let's stop the controversy and let's stop the nonsense. But
yeah.
obviously, that's not going to happen. Like I said, this article in USA Today, which was published, I guess, last night, actually, is pretty damning. Pretty damning here.
Yeah.
Where it talks about how the players and the NFL and the NFLPA were also in cahoots on what was referred to as a smash for cash program.
Unbelievable, man.
Yeah, and who was one of the who apparently is one of the ringleaders was Reggie White.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. The Reverend, huh?
Yeah.
Big Rev. God bless him. I love that guy.
So.
All right. Well. You know what? Let's just shy away from football for a little bit. We have a little over 8 minutes left in the show. Switch it over to NBA here. AP's reporting just a few minutes ago that Dallas Mavericks star forward Dirk Nowitzki will be out for at least 6 weeks after going under arthroscopic surgery to his ailing right knee. So the Mavericks will be without Nowitzki for the season opener
uh-huh.
and for a little bit after that.
Okay.
Definitely a hit to a... you know, a Mavericks team that has lost some key role players over the last few seasons. Tyson Chandler, Jason
right.
Kidd, Jason Terry.
Yep.
You know, who are they going to rely on now? Vince Carter? Come on. Poor Mark Cuban, I tell you.
Are we looking at a Mavericks team that's going to be – I mean, they've got to be in a rebuilding mode at this point.
You know what? You would think they would be, but unfortunately, you got guys like Vince Carter on this team. I like that they brought in O.J. Mayo, but you still got the Vince Carters, the Sean Marions, Elton Brand. They brought in I like that they brought in Chris Kamen. I think he's a really good fit for Dallas. Like Darren Collison. But other than that, I mean, without Dirk Nowitzki, there's really nobody there, Mike. You know, so, you know, next year is going to have to – they're going to have to start rebuilding. And you know what? I don't discount anything that Mark Cuban will do because Mark Cuban knows what to do. He's a smart basketball man.
Yeah. No
and
doubt
I'm sure
about.
He'll tell his GM to, hey, it's time to rebuild. Go out and get the good players. But I like that they brought in Mayo.
Yeah, and he's a you either love him or you hate him. He's respected, Cuban is.
Oh, absolutely.
But Nowitzki, let's get it straight. I mean, he's no spring chicken, huh? What's his age now?
Well, you know, Dirk Nowitzki's been going downhill for a little bit too. I mean, you know, he's showing shades of getting older. He is about, I'll tell you right now, he is now 34 years old. Hmm. You know, he's not the most physical player. He's not the most acrobatic player. He's very stiff. He always has been. Still a phenomenal shot, of course. But when you start to slow down with that kind of a body, it's, you know, you're going to be the first one that gets hit with it, you know.
Well, if I recall correctly, though, there was rumor of him and some of his health issues and potentially, you know, listen, would he have retired after they won the title, what, 2 years ago?
2 years ago now, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was a lot of chatter at that particular time about Nowitzki and the fact that, you know, he was, ailing, you know, the knees,
yeah.
you know, the problems that he was having, you know, back that time. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm frankly surprised I kind of thought he would have retired after they won the title. That was my thinking.
No, I mean, he still has a couple more seasons. I think he'll play to about 36, 37 years old and then call it quits unless something happens before that. He's definitely going to retire a Maverick. Cuban's not letting him go anywhere. You know what I mean? Dirk doesn't want to go anywhere. He deserves to retire a Maverick. He's done so much for that city and so much for that team that You just can't see him go anywhere.
It would be a crime. It would be a crime if he had to.
Absolutely. And listen, I hope to God that Dirk isn't going to be one of these players who goes to a team just to win one more championship and become a bench player that barely sees anything and is a broken down image of himself. I don't see Dirk being that kind of person, but I really hope he's not. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I mean, because there's so many players out there. It's just getting disgusting now that the way they do this. It's so much more than years ago. And what happened to the days when players wanted to retire with their team? Because they just love the team win lose or draw.
Well, we've talked about this before. How many do you see anymore on any team?
I hate to say it. Dirk Nowitzki's the last one.
There's a handful out there you can talk about.
I mean, Kobe's still with the same team, but, him too. I mean, I hate to say it. Kobe, I think, would be the first one. I mean, there's been so many rumors in the past that Kobe was I want to leave the Lakers because they're not bringing in anybody to play next to me or, I want to win another championship. It'll eventually happen. Kobe will leave the Lakers.
Yeah.
What's what happens? Well, listen. A little under 4 minutes left, Mike. Gonna recap on our last stupid story of the decade. Some moron bought the McJordan barbecue sauce for $10,000.
Yeah, I did read that.
Man, listen, I tell you.
Was there any comment from the moron?
Nope, he doesn't want to be known.
I guess not. Police. Who would want to be?
the man selling it is now $10,000 richer. He says, it was in my basement, and I look at it occasionally, and I thought it would be worth something someday.
Yep.
He says the guy who bought it, I'm sure he's a Bulls or Michael Jordan fan, and hopefully he's not going to put it on his ribs or his burger, but he can do whatever he wants with it. the guy says he's ecstatic. Yeah, you just sold a gallon thing of barbecue sauce that was worth nothing for $10,000.
Well, and I had also read that, as we suspected, he was a former franchise owner or manager at a McDonald's. So apparently he's got, and he's indicated, in his garage or basement or wherever the hell he's got this stuff, he's got quite a bit of McDonald's memorabilia, if you want to call it.
Listen, I am sure there is a lot of things with the McDonald's brand on it that is worth money. This thing was not worth money.
I can't imagine this would be one of them. Listen.
If there was a picture of Jordan on a bottle and it was autographed and it's the only bottle of barbecue sauce with Jordan's picture and an autograph on it and it was certified, then I could see, okay, why not? It's a piece of memorabilia. It's not. It's crap.
Well, we've seen the toys from the kids' meals.
Yeah.
Go for that are 20, 25 years old. We've seen those go for boku bucks.
Yeah, $500 for a toy or up to a grand. But
in a McDonald's kids meal, whatever they call it.
And come the freak on, man. It makes me wish that I didn't eat my half-eaten French fries. And I would have saved. I could have probably put them up on eBay for a few hundred bucks.
What the hell's the matter with you, man?
I know. What the hell did I eat those French fries for, Mike?
Yeah, will you remember that the next time? Dude, really?
Listen. Considering I don't go to McDonald's anymore? Yeah, so trust me.
When you go to McDonald's, and you go to McDonald's or any of them,
Yeah.
Next time I go,
is when I probably go into cardiac arrest.
Oh.
All right, Mike. Well, once again, another good show. We're been, doing the rundown here in seconds. But before we go, week 7 of Beat the Shark, we feature Stevie Schnur of the BC Angels of LFL Canada. Awesome interview. She's been doing phenomenal. Check it out. 8 beauties from the Lingerie Football League going against the Shark, Jeff Perini, in the NFL Pick'em League. It's week 7. Head over to Fan Junkies at YouTube. FanJunkies.net.
Yep.
Check it out. Also, another new episode of 5 Minutes at the Frat House with our own Mike McShane and sidekick Dave Weimer.
That's up.
Get over there at FratHouseSports.net. Check it out. Always good stuff from the Frat House gang.
We had a great show last night.
It was
a terrific show.
Yeah. Well, I didn't get to watch it yet, unfortunately, Mike.
Oh, no, it's good. That's all right.
Friday.
That's all right.
I'll watch it later. But then again, once again, we want to thank our special guest, Ken Avalon, the president of the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame, for joining us. phillyhole.org. Go check it out. And as always, we'll be back with you on Monday. Don't know what time yet. We'll let you know.
Yeah.
Exactly. For Mike McShane, I'm Jonathan Ragus. We'll see you all Monday.
Have a great weekend, everyone.